Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and I want to invite you to a free event next Thursday night, March 10th. I'll be moderating a debate called First Principles on the Proper Role of Government. Miles Rappaport from Demos and Yaron Brook from the Ayn Rand Institute will be the debaters. It's at 6 p.m. on March 10th at NYU Skirball Center, and tickets are free, but you need to RSVP. So go to our politics website, itsafreecountry.org, to claim your seats. And while you're at It's a Free Country, you can see our bloggers already debating the proper role of government in advance of the event. And you can take our proper role of government poll, 20 yes or no questions on the proper role of government according to you, all at itsafreecountry.org, and hope to see you out at NYU for this free event next Thursday. Well, as the UN Security Council struggles with the situation in Libya, here in New York, the UN is holding the 55th session of its Commission on the Status of Women. I'm joined now by two session participants with ties to North Africa to talk about the status of women and the current protests going on throughout the region and whether they think the changes there are going to make things better for women or maybe not, maybe even worse, with news today that in Yemen, a radical cleric is calling for the establishment of an Islamist state. Do women have more to gain or lose in these protests? Egyptian-born Laila Ahmed is a professor at the Harvard Divinity School. Her work focuses on women and religion in the Middle East and Islam in America. She's on the phone with us. Professor Ahmed, welcome to WNYC. Hello.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Hi.
And in our studio, Karima Banoon, professor at the Rutgers School of Law and a specialist on the democracy movement, women's rights, and religious extremism in the Middle East, just back from Algeria. Hi.
Good morning. It's nice to be here.
So I'm curious to get your takes both on the role of women in the protest movements and the promise or threat to women of the changes that are taking place. In general, Layla, we see a lot of angry young men in the streets on our TV screens. Are women heavily involved and heavily invested in the movements? Does it vary a lot by country?
If you think of Egypt in particular, I think they have been very involved in the movement. I think we could see them on our TV screens. I think they made up, some estimates say, around a third of the people out there in the Tahrir Square. And they were extremely important in organizing it. One of the women called Asma Mahfouz, who is credited with having played a key role in launching it, she recorded a video urging Egyptians to go out and not to take courage and not to fear what would happen. And this was before January 25th. And that is thought to be one of the tapes that got everybody out there, in which she emphasized how important it was not to give up hope and to be, and if you were going to express your hope, you had to be out in the streets. So she was one among many, many women who were very active.
Mm-hmm. That's a great story and a prominent story. Karima, does it vary by country? Not every nation in the region has the same feminist history of feminism and women's involvement that Egypt does.
Well, I think women have been engaged in these struggles in many, many countries. If you want to see pictures of women in the street, go to the Women of Egypt Facebook page, and you'll see many pictures of the women that Layla mentioned. Even in Yemen, which is much more socially conservative, there have been important women leaders in the democracy movement, such as Tawakkul Karman of the Women Journalists Without Chains, a 32-year-old mother out leading protests. And I can tell you, being just back from Algeria, women have been extremely active in the pro-democracy movement. There is an organization called the National Coordination for Change and Democracy, which is a coalition. It includes many women's groups under the rubric of the National Observatory on Violence Against Women. The women have been involved at every stage in planning the protests, in going out and leafleting to get people to come to the protests and sometimes being arrested for that, and then actually taking to the streets at the demonstrations and facing off the brutality of the police.
So, listeners, we have a few minutes for some phone calls for our guests. From Arab American women, Persian American women, who may be listening right now, with your take on where is the opportunity, where is the threat for women's advancement with the changes going on in the region. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 if you want to articulate your hopes, fears, maybe demands. 212-433-WNYC for Arab American women, Iranian American women, 212-433-9692 for our two guests with ties to the Arab world, participating in the 55th session of the UN Commission on the Status of Women here in New York right now. Leila Ahmed, I don't think there were any women on the Constitution Reform Committee in Egypt. So now that Mubarak is out, do you see women taking a big role or being allowed a big role in the new government as it takes shape?
Well, it doesn't look like it yet, but I mean, I think that's what we absolutely have to fight for. And I don't know if you saw, there was a 60 women's organization signed a protest against the absence of women on the committee shaping the Constitution.
Yes.
So I think they're very aware. And the fact that there are 60 organizations, women's organizations, tells you that there is a grassroots feminist activism or concern for women already in the country, so I hope they will continue to fight. And by the way, let me mention something that's related to women. One of the heartening things to witness in the Egyptian Tahrir Square movement was the collaboration and the commonality between Christians and Muslims. For the issue of minorities is very linked to the issue of women. So I think that the fact that there was that collaboration augurs well for women as well as for Christian-Muslim relations.
And Karima, how concerned are you about the role of conservative Islamist groups organizing to curtail women's rights as an outcome of these protests if the Islamists who are now trying to gain power in Yemen succeed, or in Algeria, which you're just back from, which has somewhat of a history of this?
I think it's certainly an issue we need to consider. I think there has been something of a flawed discourse about this all the way around. On the one hand, we've heard from some on the right that there's a sort of specter of Iranian-like theocracy if these democratic revolutionary movements go ahead, and that's been sort of an excuse for not recognizing Arab claims for democracy. On the other hand, in sort of liberal and left circles, I think people have been wowed by the golden words of Tariq Ramadan in the International Herald Tribune and sort of poo-poo any concerns about this. What I've been hearing from women, for example, at the Commission on the Status of Women, from Tunisian women, is a sort of optimistic vigilance. In other words, they take very seriously the possible risks to women's rights from, for example, the legalizing of the Ennahda party in Tunisia, the return of the leader of that fundamentalist party, Rashid al-Ghannouchi, to Tunisia, even though he has a stated commitment not to sort of curtail women's rights. They remain very engaged. They protested the night before he returned to the country. They're calling for a march for dignity, for citizenship. They're insisting on having a provision guaranteeing the equality of women in the new constitution. And they're concerned that in their country there's only one woman along with eight men on the Constitutional Reform Committee. So I think that stance of sort of optimistic vigilance, taking the issue seriously but not seeing it as a justification in any way for failing to respond to the demands of the demonstrators.
You know, Iraq has had a quota system for a couple of years now. Now, I think it's 25% of seats on local government councils that must be filled by women. Have you followed that, Karima, and have an opinion on how it's working out?
Well, it's interesting you mention that, because actually that's one of the demands that the Tunisian women are making. They want a quota system in their new electoral processes, and they've actually really called for other women's groups who have experience with these sorts of systems to engage with them. They see that as very important. They know, and we know this from the Algerian independence movement, the fact that women have been engaged and have made sacrifices in the liberation struggle does not necessarily guarantee their representation afterwards. And so the quotas are about making sure that that happens.
Have you thought about this, Leila? Would you advocate that for other Arab countries starting new democracies?
I think, yes, it sounds like a very good idea. But in fact, Egypt has a history of having women in parliament and has had different points and has also required a certain number of seats for women. So I think it needs to be to draw on that history, because I think Karima's phrase, optimistic vigilance, is just exactly right, exactly what we need. It looks good, but we got to be watch what happens now.
People in the U.S. react so negatively to the idea of a quota to make up for past discrimination. Is the context different in the Arab world, do you think, Karima?
I think the debate will be considerably different in the Arab world about this, and I think it will be in some ways more politically acceptable, in other ways less politically acceptable, but it's certainly a demand that women are making, and I think that they have earned the right to be represented.
Leila Ahmed, Egyptian-born professor at the Harvard Divinity School, whose work focuses on women and religion in the Middle East and Islam in America, and Karima Banoon, professor at the Rutgers Law School and a specialist on the democracy movement, women's rights, and religious extremism in the Middle East. She's just back from Algeria as we talk about the prospects for women from all this change in the Middle East. Leila, do you think we get locked in this country into Western assumptions about what it means to have women's rights? Certainly, we could go down the list of things we think of: equal pay for equal work, reproductive rights, no glass ceiling, family leave, including paternal leave, strong rape and domestic violence laws and enforcement. Are these the same things that women in the Middle East need to demand now?
This is the ideal list, but I think you need an atmosphere where such demands are possible. Some of these are already definitely possible, and in fact, I believe in Egypt has had equal pay for equal for women since the 1950s. So there are some demands that are already there and will not be hard to negotiate. But here we have an atmosphere only after the feminist revolution of the 60s and 70s, in which it's possible to put many of these issues on the table and expect mm-hmm. that people will at least fight for them.
But I guess I'm curious if you think those are the right questions, or whether that's an American or a Western assumption about what women in the Middle East should be thinking about.
Well, but I think they are. I mean, these are ideals. They're not the only things they should be thinking about. There are issues in regard to law and rights in the law in relation to marriage and divorce and child custody that are extraordinarily important also in the Muslim context. Mm-hmm. But I think those that you listed also are grounding ideals.
Karima, same question. What are we missing through our cultural lens?
Well, I'd like to focus on what the Algerian women's rights movement is demanding. They are demanding the abrogation of the gender discriminatory family code, which is often justified on religious grounds by its supporters. They are demanding a new law to protect women from violence. And in fact, they know that they need democracy to do that work, because I tried to attend last October a symposium that they had organized to demand this new law. And in fact, that symposium was declared unauthorized by the authorities the night before, and then had to take place sort of in a back room somewhere. So they are focusing on these issues, including the issue of democracy as the enabler for their work, on social justice for young people in the country. And I think when we think about what we should push for, we should really take the lead from them.
Leila, I gather you have a book coming out about Islamic women and the wearing of the veil.
I do, yes.
How does that connect with the question of political power and social equality?
Well, it connects radically. I mean, one of the things I was doing, I thought what I did was follow out why women are wearing the veil today when they didn't in my generation 50 years ago. So it actually comes from Egypt through the Muslim Brotherhood to America, and it's become now a global movement. But what I observed as I followed out how it's developing now in America is that many of the women who were influenced by that history are among the leading feminists today. They're very committed Muslims and very committed. They don't call themselves feminists, but they're committed to women's rights, and they're very active in the field of women's rights, including the reinterpretation of the Quran, which some of them say has always been interpreted by men, which is why we have the rules that we have. So it's a very active and lively, dynamic movement today in America of Muslims rethinking, Muslim women in particular, rethinking what the implications of Islam are now that we live in a free country where women may interpret the Quran just as much as well as men.
So you don't think feminist in a veil is an oxymoron?
Absolutely not. I've seen it living before my eyes.
Karima?
My take on this is perhaps slightly different. The women's rights movement in Algeria, I think for historical reasons, tends to be very committed to the principle of secularism and advocating for universal human rights for women. The same thing, I think, tends to be true in neighboring Tunisia as well, if we look at some of the statements that have been made recently. And in fact, many women's rights advocates have expressed concern to me in Algeria about the sort of increasing pressures socially on women to dress more and more conservatively. And of course, there's a very negative history to this in Algeria, because during the terrible civil war in the 1990s between the military-backed government and the armed fundamentalist groups, the fundamentalists threatened unveiled women and, in fact, shot and killed a number of young unveiled girls on the streets.
I'd like to add a comment to that, please. Critical to this discussion is what country we're in. America's a free country. So if I were talking about the veil in some other country where it's required by law, then what the veil means and its potential for feminism is a very different story from what it is in America or Europe.
So we'll come back in a week and have this whole conversation again and start with the word Saudi Arabia. But for now, we thank Leila Ahmed from the Harvard Divinity School, author of the forthcoming book, due out in May, A Quiet Revolution, The Veil's Resurgence from the Middle East to America, and Karima Bounoun of Rutgers Law School, democracy expert just back from Algeria, and they're both participating in the UN's 55th session of its Commission on the Status of Women at this historic moment. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.